Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Mind Shift Podcast. I'm super excited to welcome Dr. Terry Daniel to the show. She is an expert on grief counseling, but specifically what I want to talk to Terry about is this issue of her new book, which is entitled Grief in God, When Religion Does More Harm Than Healing. And that to me is an absolutely fascinating thing, kind of reminiscent of my chat with Dave Warnock, which was on just a little bit ago. From Dying Out Loud, how do you face death? And this is something that Terry is an expert in, and specifically the impact of religion around this topic of death. And that is, I'm absolutely fascinated. So thank you, Terry, for dropping in. Thanks for being a guest on Mindshift Podcast.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here, and I'm really happy to look forward to this conversation.
Yeah, so am I. So one of the connections that we've already established is Janice Selby. So you're going to be speaking at her Court 2020, the conference on religious trauma next year in Vancouver, BC. And you were saying you're super excited to be going to that conference.
Yeah, well, when I looked at her website and I saw that some of the speakers were people that I actually referenced in my dissertation, I was just jumping for joy to be among them. And I sent her a proposal and I said, you know, I talk about bad theology in relation to grief and healing and trauma. So that was a perfect fit. So I'm super, super thrilled to be there. And I also found that when I was doing my doctoral research on this, there's a whole lot of research on toxic theology. And we'll talk about that in a minute and how that's defined. There's also research on complicated grief when a grieving person doesn't go through the expected trajectories of healing as what is, you know, normative. But I saw nothing that linked the two together. So I was really happy to say, okay, well, I see a link between these two things, and that's
absolutely
my career, and that's going to be my research. And I'm sure other people have done it, but it's not widely published anywhere. So I'm kind of hoping I'm the first person.
You're the first one. And of course, that's the whole point of doing a doctoral thesis, isn't it? You've got to find something that's adding to the field of knowledge, the body of research. So I'm glad you were able to find that sort of niche and carve out a little spot talking about theology. I was going to say too that it's all about making those connections, isn't it? Because we were talking about Dave Warnock a little bit before we hit record. Also, some of the people that are going to be at the conference, I'm going to be having as guests on the show, Dr. Janja Lalich, who's an expert on cults and cult psychology. She's a sociologist. She's going to be at the Court 2020. I think as well, Dr. Marlene Winnell is also going to be on the show. So I'm glad that we were able to meet up with Janice. She's been on my podcast a couple of times. Unfortunately, I can't make the conference next April because I can't get out of teaching commitments in the UK, but she actually invited me to be on an ex-pastor panel at the conference, but I was absolutely gutted to have to say I couldn't make it. So sorry, but maybe next year, maybe there'll be another one.
You know, maybe she could do, you know, like a Zoom with you.
Yeah, I thought about that.
Doable.
I have a feeling though that it's going to be at like 3 a.m. in here in the UK. But you know what? I would get up for that. I would get up at 3 a.m. I don't know if my wife would be real happy with that, you know, but because our cottage over here is so small that my bedroom is my you know studio and everything else. So yeah we'll see. But there's always a way with technology, isn't there?
Yeah, but you should be there. Anyway.
Oh, I would love to be there. My sister Valerie is going to go. We did go up. I was in Seattle last July, so we were able to go up to Vancouver. We met up with Janice Selby and a bunch of people that I've met through the podcast. So that was really, really a great time to meet her and her husband. They came down from Kelowna, BC. So we spent the weekend with a bunch of people, and it was just great. I mean, meeting those, it's another community, isn't it? You're forming a new tribe. And it wouldn't be possible without Twitter and Facebook, the marvels of technology. So you're in California, I'm here in North Wales, but, you know, we're having this amazing conversation. Or hopefully it will be amazing. I'm sure it will be.
So far, so good.
So what's led you into this field of research? I mean, you said you found this niche. Did you come out of a religious background yourself?
No, I had. I'm very lucky that I had no religious background. My family was Jewish, and they were very secular. For them, it was more of a social thing. As I mentioned to you earlier, I once asked my father when I was a kid where Jews go when they die, and he said to the Cadillac dealership. He thought
at least they get a Cadillac.
Yeah, to drive on the golden streets. Right?
Golden streets, you got to ride. Wow, man, solid gold hubcaps and everything.
On your mansion and all
yeah.
that. So I had no religious upbringing, but I always was interested in religion. I don't know why. When I was in high school, strangely enough, in Los Angeles, totally secular school, there was an English class called The Bible as Literature. Now, why they would teach that in a public Los Angeles school, I do not know. The teacher was this very old man, and I had never looked at a Bible in my life, so I was 16. And he taught us the first five books, the Pentateuch, as literature, the same way you would look at it in a historical critical study. And, you know, he was saying, you know, keep in mind that human beings wrote this, and they had a certain political leanings and messages they were trying to put across. And I was blown away. So I read the whole Bible after that when I was 16, just because I was curious, like, what is the big deal about this?
Right. That was your first foray into the Bible. Well, I was going to say, I think the reason they did Bible as literature is because that's the only way they could sort of sneak it past the censors, as it were, in a public school to present it as literature, not as a, quote, proselytizing or religious thing. So,
but
yeah.
He wasn't proselytizing at all. I mean, yeah. in just like exegesis, you know, like the right way. It blew me away that. So what I think what he was really trying to sneak in was critical thinking.
Exactly.
But I didn't think he was sneaking in Bible teaching. But he was
He wasn't an undercover evangelical trying to convince you that Ken Ham was right about the answers in Genesis and everything.
He was an undercover free thinker masquerading as an undercover evangelical.
Yeah, that's the only way you got the gig was to... Yeah, I'll teach the Bible in a public school. I mean, you've got to be an evangelical to want to do that. I mean, this is off the subject, but there's a huge push in evangelical and fundamental circles to get the Bible back into the public school system, as we know. So, yeah, there's some stuff, Project Blitz and some other things that are going on. So, anyway, that has nothing to do with your topic. But
a great topic, too. So
this is what I studied.
Around the same time, a Hare Krishna temple moved in around the corner from my house, also in Los Angeles. So I started going over there to see what that was about. And my father, the one who told me that Jews get Cadillacs in heaven when they die, was a European intellectual. He was an artist, and he had a lot of books. And so I started pulling books off his bookshelves. You know, he had books on comparative religion, Carl Jung, stuff like that. So I just kind of got into the mystical world. Then I discovered psychedelics. That helped open up the door to that. And so I just wanted to understand what the big deal was about all this. So fast forward many, many, many years. The reason I got into this academically is I got really involved in hospice work and helping people die, because being with a dying person is a very profound and pristine experience. And long story short, I wanted to have deeper and deeper experiences with these patients and families. So I went into training to be a chaplain. So I am considered an interfaith chaplain. And I worked in hospitals and hospices. And so when I would walk into a patient's room and I'd say, hello, I'm the chaplain, they would say, oh, no, 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 I don't believe in God. And I'd say, good, I don't believe in that God either. And that would open for me to talk to them. So as a chaplain, I started to see all these people, the ones who did believe in that God, really, really suffering over facing death and facing illness because of their toxic theologies and the things that they believed. For example, I was a good person. I went to church. I tithed. I loved Jesus. I did all this. Why do I have cancer? This wasn't supposed to happen to me.
Yeah, it doesn't fit. The pieces don't fit.
Yeah, it's your basic cognitive dissonance.
Exactly. And that's the thing. It's ironic that as we're recording this today, my wife is in Seattle attending the funeral of her mother, which she suddenly passed away about a month ago, very shockingly and suddenly. And so, yeah, that's brought up all this other stuff because a lot of our family is still evangelical. So here come the platitudes and all those sort of things that you start to hear on, you know, you see the posts on Facebook when you put something like that out there that, you know, her mom has died and all these people start weighing in and here come those same kind of things that, and you think, my God, I used to say that stuff too, as an, but it brings you solace. It quells the cognitive dissonance, as you say.
I guess for some, I mean, the reason I got into hospice work is because my son died when he was 16. Mm. He had a rare metabolic disorder and he was severely disabled the last half of his life. So my experience of caregiving and being with him through death was, you know, just life changing. And yeah, I heard those platitudes. You know, I remember had a neighbor who was evangelical, who was missionary, and they had just come back from Africa and brought this African woman back with them. And she barely spoke English. And so there was my son, he was dead. And my neighbor came over and said, "Can I bring this girl over to say a prayer?" And I'm like, "Sure, you know, fine.
Why not?"
Yeah, so she comes in and she sings this most beautiful little song in this beautiful African language. It was so gorgeous. I asked her to sing it a second time and she sang it. And then when she was done, I said, "What does it mean?" And she said, "Well, I'm asking the Lord to allow your son into heaven."
Okay.
It's like, really?
You shouldn't have asked for the translation.
I didn't think to ask first. And then I went, "No, but you know what? To me, it's okay, fine. Ask your God whatever you want."
Sure, whatever. Yeah.
But it's kind of, you know, and I didn't get into an argument with her, but it's like, look at this innocent little child laying here, you know. If there is a God in heaven in that format, why would he need permission to go there? So that's the kind of stuff I started seeing. And I see it on Facebook all the time too. You know,
it is amazing. This is something that Dave Warnock said in our podcast, because he's facing death himself. He's been diagnosed with ALS. He's got some 3 to 5 years life expectancy. And he said that as he goes around the country talking to people on his Dying Out Loud tour, he said the people that he talks to the most, or that talk to him, I should say, are Christians who are terrified of death. And he says, now that shouldn't be. If you believe your system, take it to its logical conclusion, Christians should embrace death. They should be ecstatic that they're going to be going to heaven, walking the streets of gold in their Cadillac and all the rest of it. Why then are they so terrified? Because it provides all the answers, surely. Isn't that, that's what I was told as a Christian.
So why are they terrified? Is it because some part of them knows that it's bullshit? And
deep down, or suspects it at least.
Or suspects it, but that part of them is like so buried and so pushed into the background that they can't even access it. You know, when the last Pope died, and you could see on TV, there were millions of people in the streets crying and sobbing. And that was
devastated.
It's like, surely they believe this dude's going to heaven.
If anyone's going to heaven, it's the Pope.
Yeah.
And you hope.
Why are they so sad?
Yeah, they should be rejoicing, not that he's dead, but that he's in heaven. He's in a better place.
And there's another side of that thinking in terms of grief that is same idea, but a different aspect of it is for a lot of Christians, that becomes a complicating factor in their grief. And so I do have to work with Christians who are grieving sometimes, and I have to, you know, support them. So they will say things like, "I'm supposed to be happy that my person died, because I know he's going to heaven and Jesus is waiting for him, but I'm not happy. So I must not be a good Christian." And that brings in a whole complicated cycle of misery for them.
It's unbelievable. And like you say, the platitudes, they sound good, but we saw this a year and a half, 2 years ago. We've been through a lot of death. I mean, there's been 8 people that have died that we were close to in the last 2 years. It's been quite a shocking sort of 2 years, but, and my wife's mom being the 8th one in that 2 years, but her dad died of a brain tumor about 14 months ago now. And we were there working with him. My wife moved to Seattle and basically cared for him for the last 6 months. And again, we heard those same platitudes and the narrative kept shifting as he got worse and worse. You know, it was like God was going to heal him. That was the first thing. So all these prayers were offered up. Then that was obviously not going to be happening. He was not getting better. And then it was, well, God has a plan, but we don't know what it is. You know, he's trying to teach us something, you know, and the narrative just kept shifting. I heard someone say, well, God must have needed another angel in his choir. That's why he took him home.
Another flower in the garden. Yeah.
Yeah. And at no point was God ever responsible or culpable for actually giving him this brain tumor that killed him. So you go, wait a minute, if God is in control of everything, then surely he allowed it or gave him the tumor that killed him. So that doesn't add up. So yeah, there's a lot of questions around this for Christians when it comes to death, isn't there?
Well, yeah, well, with petitionary prayer, God always gets the credit when the person survives, but never gets blamed when the person dies.
Exactly. And he always has an escape clause.
Yeah.
That's what I say.
You know, and what I always say too is like, you know, is God in the protection racket?
Yeah, like a mafia boss.
Yeah, like a mafia boss. It's like, you know, if I do this, this, and this, I will be protected. This is one of the primary assumptions of Judeo-Christian religious belief, Jewish belief as well. You know, that's why the book of Job is so important, because it just completely challenged all those beliefs. So, and getting back to my book, let me talk a little bit about defining toxic beliefs, because it's pretty interesting, and it's all pretty self-explanatory, but it's, let's see, uniquely compromises the whole self, spiritual, mental, emotional, and physical, undermines mental health. It's an authoritarian power hierarchy that demands obedience, has policies of separatism, restricted access to outside sources of information. This is a cult for sure.
I was going to say, you're ticking off the markers here, Terry. Yeah. I was just going to go down that same line.
Yeah, it's on page 8 and 9 in my book. A threat-based reality.
Yep.
Health, mind punishment, catastrophic end times. Psychological mind control techniques that encourage isolation. Followers are held to a rigid, unyielding system of beliefs. Questioning and exploration is discouraged. Outsiders are viewed with suspicion and disdain. Religious pluralism is unacceptable. Biblical texts are interpreted literally, of course. God is seen as an authoritarian parental figure, and a belief that God rewards piety and faithfulness. That pretty much sums it up.
That pretty much sums it up. I mean, I was going to say, most of the things you just rattled off are classic sort of cult, as you said, cult psychological markers. We just did a podcast, Chris Shelton and I, and we went through Robert J. Lifton's 8 markers of cults. And a lot of those are similar to what you just listed. Yes, maybe tailored specifically to evangelical or Christian theology, but the mind control, the thought-stopping cliches, the self-policing of your own thoughts, all that kind of stuff, not being able to think critically or being discouraged, certainly from, they can bring a lot of pressures to bear on someone who starts questioning the status quo. So yeah, it's a toxic system for sure.
And even if someone isn't living in a cult-like environment, even if you're just, you know, the average Christian family down the block, even if they don't even go to church or have a church community, just believing in this system, even if you believe in it independently by yourself, it is a cult, but it doesn't have like the social supports that a cult might have. It's just dangerous and inhibitive to growth and evolution in any way you look at it. And so if you look at the way it happens with loss and trauma is, most of us are given our theological structures when we're about 5 years old, right? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old in Sunday school. Even though I had no religious upbringing, I absorbed it from the culture, television, Christmas, all that stuff. And so by the time you're 7, you're pretty locked in to this idea of God as an authoritarian parent that alternates from being a protector and a punisher. Protector, punisher, protector, punisher. Mm-hmm. That's crazy. And so you're 7 years old, and that's where you're stuck there. And you never think about it again, most people, as you go through your life. It's constantly supported by the culture. And then one day you're 47, and your kid dies, or you get ALS. And that's when you start thinking about it again. Now you're going to go back and revisit what you learned when you're 7, but you're coping with an adult crisis using the thinking of a 7-year-old.
Yeah. You didn't have the capacity to reason it through at 7 years old. That's the thing about that I've said before, that growing up in fundamentalism like I did, we just bought into it because that was our worldview. That was what we grew up. I literally grew up in church from day one. I was a baby when I was about a week old. I think I was sitting on my mom's lap in the church service, and I was there every Sunday for the rest of my life up until, you know, 10 or 12 years ago when I finally walked away from it all. So yeah, that was the bubble. I was inside it. I was drinking the Kool-Aid, and a lot of people are the same way. Well, I was going to go back to, I wanted to explore that analogy. You mentioned a protection racket. That is such an apt sort of metaphor, I think, for the typical Christian relationship, in air quotes, I should say, with God. Because think about what you said. It's a reward and punishment type thing. He will protect you, quote unquote, from calamity if you pay him. So in our metaphor of the Christian theology, you read your Bible, you pray, you go to church, you know, you do all the right things, and you're supposed to be blessed and taken care of. It's just that, like Job, when the shit hits the fan, Job didn't have, there was no reason for any of that to happen to him from his point of view, was there? He had done all the right things, and yet he's totally suffering, and he never finds out the whole thing was a cosmic bet between, you know, God and Satan. So that's another whole layer to the piece anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's the protection racket is a quid pro quo, which
yeah,
is
that's a relevant talking point right now.
Yes, pretty much. I say it all the time.
No, Terry, there was no quid pro quo. Didn't you hear Trump?
I mean, if anyone's paying attention to the news in America right now, it's going to go into our theological discussion, which is great. You know, you got to wonder, I mean, I don't really wonder, why was the book of Job written at all? Mm. And it's because whoever wrote it, or whatever group of people wrote it, was saying, this theology that we've been given doesn't make any sense. Mm. So how can we express our confusion in a mythical story? Because that's what mythical stories are, is just a way to express something, you know, as metaphor. And so that's why they came up with that very useful story, which has no conclusion. And basically, you know, if there's a conclusion to it, it's like, you know, shit happens. But there's, where did I see this? Okay. One of the coolest things ever is, if you can find this on YouTube, it was a stage play, and then they made a film out of it called God on Trial. You ever heard of this?
I haven't heard of it.
Look for it on YouTube, and when you have a minute, watch the whole thing. It's about an hour long. It's a play that was written, takes place in a concentration camp. And there's a bunch of guys, and they're all like, you know, Jews, prisoners, and they're scholars. One guy's a physicist, and one guy's a rabbi, and one guy's a lawyer. And they're having a conversation saying, if in our theology we're the chosen people, and we're obedient, and we do what God wants, why are we in this concentration camp, and why is this happening? So they decide that God is guilty of breach of contract. And they have a mock trial, and they put God on trial, and they have a defense and a prosecution, and it's absolutely amazing. And the conclusion that they come up with, I wrote it down here so that I wouldn't forget it. They talk about the book of Job, and they say the conclusion is that we're not being punished necessarily, and we're not good and obedient either. We're not guilty or innocent. We're just powerless.
Wow.
And that's the
conclusion.
Yeah, and that's the conclusion of the Judeo-Christian thing. Yeah. We're just powerless.
And do you want to be a pawn in this system, in this game? Because I was convinced, even when I was a Christian, that most Christians that I encountered, and even I did too, you have this sort of reward and punishment theology. And that's basically the way it works. If you do good, God will bless you and take care of you. And if you sin, yes, deservedly so, you should get punished in that system. The problem happens, as in your experience, I'm sure far more than mine, when suffering and death comes into the picture. What have I done to deserve this? I've done everything. I've ticked off all the boxes. How do you help people, you know, negotiate and travel through that, especially people that are Christians that are struggling with their toxic theology?
That's a really good question. And that's something that I teach when I do trainings for chaplains. And this is what we learn as a chaplain. When somebody's questioning their theology, you just turn it right back on them and put it on their lap. So a good example is a case that I had a guy who was a real badass biker guy. He was a meth dealer and meth cooker. And at some point in his career, he had found Jesus and still was a meth dealer. But now
meth dealer for Jesus. Dealing it out of the back of the church off his Harley.
Pretty much, that's what he was doing. So I met him when he was in the hospital, and he said, you know, I'm saved. I love Jesus. Jesus is my savior, even though I still do this bad stuff, and now I'm dying. Am I going to go to hell? When I accepted Jesus, did that stick? Or did Jesus leave the minute I went back to cooking meth? Or is he still with me? Is he supposed to be? This was his conundrum. And so I said to him, this is what you do, how you help someone with that. As I said, you tell me, what does your faith say about this, about your relationship with Jesus? And I make them say it to me, because I'm not going to tell them what I think. I'm not supposed to. And he'll sit there and think, and he goes, well, you know, once saved, always saved, and I'm always forgiven, no matter how much meth I cook. Jesus will always love me and forgive me. That's what my faith tells me. So then I say, well, dude, you're good to go.
You're right off into the sunset, man.
There's wow. A cat waiting for you.
What a system. But they've got to come up with something that works. Ultimately, like you say, the threat of, yeah, and that was always another big issue as a Christian was, am I really saved? Like this biker guy is talking about, and it's got to be exacerbated by the fact that, yeah, now you're staring death in the face, right. And you're shitting yourself because you're thinking, man, am I really going to go to heaven or am I going to the other place? We haven't talked about hell, but that's the other side of the toxic theology, isn't it? Is that you can play that card, you can implant that phobia in young children. And I believed it. I was terrified I was going to get left behind when the rapture occurred and that I was going to go to hell, you know, and I can remember freaking out as a kid thinking, you know, that I'd missed the rapture and all the rest of it. I mean, what a burden to place on a young person, a young child, and implant that phobia of a place like hell, eternal conscious torment in hell. So, this biker was freaking out, I'm sure, too.
So when you're a child and you're afraid of being left behind after the rapture, so did you ever have a moment like you woke up in the middle of the night and your parents were asleep and the house was quiet and you thought, oh my God, are they all gone?
I did. I did a story about this where I had seen a movie called A Thief in the Night. I did actually a whole podcast episode on this because there's so many people that were traumatized like me watching these movies in churches as kids. Because it was specifically designed and marketed to be shown in churches, not in movie theaters in the 70s and 80s. And I came home one day and everybody was gone. And I freaked out. I ran next door. I switched the news on thinking it was going to be all over the news. I was crying, panicking, you know. And so as probably 12, 13-year-old kid, that's the sort of level of fear, dread, trauma. You know, I was convinced that the rapture had happened, that I'd been left behind. And I was going to go to hell, you know. What a system, huh? Talk about toxic theology, man.
I'm just really happy for you that you're here now.
Yeah, that's why I got one of the reasons why I got out. But what I'm seeing now and talking to so many people, psychotherapists and, you know, people like Janice and others, that the amount of psychological damage that it does and you retain that all the way in, you know, I'm still dealing with the triggering and other things that sort of thing did to me as such a young age. You're such a formative age, isn't it, to be indoctrinated that way. Hey everyone, we're just going to take a very short break. We're going to get right back into my conversation with Dr. Terry Daniel. We're going to pick up that thread talking about what these sort of toxic theological beliefs do to kids, especially at a young age when your parent dies and you're told something horrific by a friend, a family member, or something like that. What does it actually do to a young child? It is unbelievable. I just wanted to interrupt this podcast for a minute and talk about some of the stuff that's coming up. Things have been going a bit weird in our lives too, and it's kind of ironic that this episode with Terry Daniels coming out when it does, because just a couple of Fridays ago, we received that phone call that every parent dreads. 1 o'clock in the morning, here's this phone call from my daughter, and it's very horrible, tragic news. Her fiance Jack had been involved in a very tragic accident and unfortunately passed away. And so we dropped everything and raced off in the middle of the night to
see her in the hospital together with his parents. And of course, we were obviously all shocked and devastated at this very tragic and senseless event that took place just out of the blue.
And it's ironic, as I say, that here I am talking with Terry Daniel about death and dying and facing that. And it really caused us to reflect that, you know, looking at our daughter, and she's obviously devastated. The family's absolutely shocked and devastated that her fiance died so suddenly and tragically. But as a Christian, when I was an evangelical, I would have taken refuge in all those platitudes and all those thought-terminating cliches to get some semblance of sort of order and get some answers and to stop the critical thinking. But now we're not doing that. We're not facing death in that same way, and it's quite a different approach. And you know, we've lost so many people. I think we've lost actually 10 people in the last 2 years. And it's been a shocking thing to have to go through that. But I'm glad for people like Terry, who is helping people work through those sort of issues. So I'm hopeful that you're finding this episode very interesting as well as helpful. What we're going to get into in the second half, we're going to talk a little bit more about this toxic theology, but we're also going to get into this issue of what about talking to people from beyond the grave? Can that happen? Do you believe in communicating with people who have departed? And is that something that can help you sort of maybe recover as part of that grief and loss process? So we're going to get into that a little bit too. I just wanted to say, I'm not really sure what's coming up in the next couple of weeks. I've got a couple of people that I've been talking to about doing some episodes, but because of the situation with my daughter's fiance passing away very suddenly, it's kind of thrown everything into sort of disarray. I'm going to be talking to Lilith Liberated. I've also been in touch with Dr. Andre Gagne. We're going to be doing another episode on Dominion Theology in January sometime. So there's some fantastic content headed your way. If you want to reach out to me, you can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. You can send me a message there or get on Facebook, look up the MindShift Podcast Facebook page. You can like that page and send me an email through that if you want to get a hold of me.
And just one last thing, thank you to Arte Soma, who is the latest $5 a month level Patreon supporter of this show. Thank you for your support. And in fact, there's some great benefits to being a Patreon supporter of the show. And if you want to find out more about that, the links to that are in the show notes.
And in fact, speaking of which, one of the great benefits that you get for being a Patreon supporter is you get access to our monthly MindShift podcast Zoom calls. Last month we had Brady Harden. This month we had this guest that I'm talking to you right now, Dr. Terry Daniel, on the 8th of December. An absolutely fantastic conversation talking about grief, God, death, dying, and people getting a chance to get to know Terry and sort of working through some of their issues. So that is a fantastic benefit. You get to talk to people like Brady and Terry. It's just an amazing thing to be a part of that. And I'm really glad to be bringing those to the group every month. Anyway, without further ado, let's get back into the conversation with Dr. Terry Daniel. We're going to pick up this thread of talking about toxic theology, what it does to kids, and then we're going to get into speaking with people from beyond the grave. Is that a thing? Is that real? Does it actually happen? Terry's going to unpack a little bit of that for you. So I hope you find that fascinating as we get back into the conversation with Terry Daniel.
And then when you have a loss at that age, so I once facilitated an art therapy group for grieving children. And I tell this story in my book. So I had these three adolescent boys, their parents had all just died. And they were in this grief group. They were like 11, 12, 13. And they were having a conversation. And one kid, the first kid said, "My dad was a really bad guy. You know, he was in prison. He was a drug addict and he died. Do you think he's going to go to heaven?" And the second kid said, "Sure he is. God forgives everybody. Of course he's going to heaven." And the third kid, who was the youngest of the three, said, "But how is there room for all those people up in the sky? I mean, there's so many people and there's not enough room." So this conversation between these three kids really showed me how that thinking is in the mind of a child. And so when these kids go home after they've been in my group and they go home to their parents and ask these questions, if they're even allowed to ask, which they're probably not, depending on how the parents answer those questions is going to form that kid forever.
Absolutely.
It's so dangerous at that age, especially when your dad dies when you're 11 years old.
Yeah.
And maybe it was a suicide or a drug overdose. And grandma says, your dad went to hell because he killed himself, and you're 11 years old, you're just going to be destroyed.
Imagine, yeah, putting that burden on a young kid who's already obviously devastated at losing his or her father at that young age, and then to say that to the kid, well, he's in hell now. Wow, that doesn't help at all. Actually, it makes things a lot worse, doesn't it? Knowing dad is in eternal conscious torment in hell for having killed himself. I mean, in Catholicism, suicide is like a big one, isn't it? If you kill yourself, you're going to go to hell.
Well, actually, in Catholicism, that's actually changing now.
Oh, right.
It's not a set in stone part of the doctrine. In fact, in my book, I interviewed I know a lot of former Catholic priests, kind of like I know a lot of former evangelicals.
Right.
And he said that it's not a set in stone rule of the church anymore, that there's caveats. Like, if you kill yourself, you know, because you're not in the right mind, which most people aren't, you know,
when you got to that point.
Yeah. It's like, you know, you're suffering, you're sick, something's wrong. So you don't have to go to hell for that. Well, what are the reasons you need to kill yourself, you know?
So there's dispensations apparently now for, I know people were terrified of that forever, weren't they? That if I am struggling so badly that I think I'm going to end my own life, I'm not going to do it because I'll go straight to hell as a Catholic.
Yeah.
What a deterrent.
And there's also, I was asking this priest that I interviewed for my book about, you know, what does make you go to hell? Is there, you know, a list of the actual...
It's got to be a list.
Well, there's actually a lot of lists, and it's depending on who you ask, but, you know, we were talking about Nigerian Catholic priests earlier. I found one website from Nigeria where he had this long list. You know, masturbation will send you straight to hell. Divorce, looking at pornography, a lot of sexual stuff, of course.
Of course.
And, you know, the priest told me, you know, Catholic stuff is like, it's much looser now. Like, the Catholic Church is actually letting go of that whole concept a little bit right now. Slowly but surely. They're in so much trouble.
I was going to say, yeah, they've got pedophile priests and all the rest of it. Yeah, they need to loosen up somewhere because they're in a lot of trouble in a lot of other places, aren't they?
Yeah, and, you know, they have, you know, a halfway decent pope now who's got, you know, somewhat of an open mind. So, I mean, the whole church structure is coming down anyway.
I think it is, yeah. And we're seeing, again, this is not on our subject, but in America for sure, evangelicalism, they're making this huge last sort of desperate gambit, aren't they, to retain control politically in another way. So yeah, that might be the death rattle of evangelicalism in America, but they might win. I don't know.
Well, the millennials, statistically, in the last research that the Pew Research on Religion did, are the most secular generation on record.
Yeah, I saw that.
Anywhere, you know, so...
Yeah, the trends are going away from, yeah, as the new generations coming up are increasingly identifying as those nuns, don't they? They say, I have no religious affiliation, none at all. So I'm a nun, I guess.
Oh, no, it's really, the first class that I took when I started in seminary, in my doctorate program, was called The Spirituality of the Nuns, and SBNRs, meaning spiritual but not religious. So I had to study all those statistics, and it was really interesting. And I also read a great book by, Harvey Cox, maybe, is a guy who studies religious trends. And he identified like the 40s, 50s, and early 60s, you know, as he called it in America, the era of civic religion. It was just hand in hand with you're a male, you're white, you're American, you're a Protestant.
You're a Christian, yeah.
There's nothing else. A Protestant is not Catholic, because Catholics are outside that loop.
Oh, and, I see. It's too broad of a circle.
Yeah, and so in 1955, there was a study called Catholics, Christians, and Jews. This is 55. I was 2 years old. And it was this massive study, large number of people, and they found that something like 95% of Americans identified as one of those three things, 95%. Today, if you did that same study, it would probably be 35%.
Well, I was going to ask you, going back to your work as a chaplain and dealing with people as they're passing through, what's your advice for people who are in sort of maybe in that position? Maybe they're facing it, or they think, man, when I get to that point, and I've got these strong sort of Christian or religious beliefs. How do you work through that? What's your advice now? I mean, I'm sure you've talked to so many thousands of people over the years. What have you found to be helpful?
Well, first they have to ask for that help, of course, right? So let's assume that they're saying, I'm conflicted about this, and they come to me and they say, can you help me resolve this? I have some pretty cool tools for that. And a lot of that comes from the fact that we are a multicultural world now because of the internet. So you can go on the internet and you could see death rituals in Ghana or Muslim prayers or Hindu funeral services. I mean, everything is out there. So one of the first things I do is I introduce people to different cultures' views of death and the afterlife. And that blows their minds because they've never heard anything else. Mm-hmm. And then if I'm doing a workshop on this, I will do experiential exercises and ceremonies and rituals that have no religious context at all. So for example, I'll just give you an example. I just did this at my mother's funeral, and I teach this to people all the time, where at the funeral, you pass around a little basket of rose petals. And everybody takes 3 rose petals. And this comes from the shamans in Peru. And you blow your breath into each rose petal. And so you're doing like opening the chest, breath work. And you blow in the first one all your anger and your rage and your sadness and your pain of losing this person. And in the second one, you blow all your love and your happy memories of this person. And in the third rose petal, you blow any message that you would like to give them now, even though they're dead, something you didn't say before. And you put this all into the rose petals. And then if it's an open grave cemetery, everybody gathers around and throws the rose petals into the grave.
Yeah.
Gives all that stuff to the dead person, metaphorically. It's beautiful. So when I do something like this with religious people, they go, wow, that was very meaningful. Very healing, very spiritual, and there was no religious dogma attached to it of any kind. I could not identify that to any religion if I tried. And so that's a really good tool, is giving people processes to do that are not in a religious context. That opens up the eyes.
No dogma attached. You didn't preach a sermon from the Bible and then hand the rose petals out.
No, and you didn't say, you know, I forgive her for her sins, or, you know, this is to set bless her in heaven. It's just, it's all of that stuff is stripped out. If you strip all that stuff out of any religious system, you're going to be left with something actually quite nice and useful, which for lack of a better term, you could call it spiritual or mystical, but it's your inner self. It's your love. It's your heart. It's your sense of calm. It might be your sense of connection with the vast universe, you know, including plant life and
whatever it is.
And whatever it is, you know, the ions in the sky, whatever. None of that stuff is religious, but the formation of religious belief was based on all that stuff, right? I mean, everything started with primitive people looking up in the sky and seeing stars and saying, I wonder what those are. And, you know, why is that one? Look, it's in the shape of a horse. And this one, and if we lay outside and we sleep outside and we see them moving, you know, we start to construct stories about it. So like one of the stories of the Greeks was that the gods lived up there. And in their world, it was always light. But in our world, it's dark. And so the gods would get angry with each other and have arguments. And they would stab their spears into the floor, which poked little holes that the light came through, which looks to us like stars. Humans make this stuff up. That's what mythology is.
But it helps make sense of the world, doesn't it? It explains things. And I think that's the thing about death in particular, isn't it? We need, as you say, a way in which to process through the grief, the loss, the anger, whatever circumstance surrounded the person who died. I mean, we had a very close friend that passed away 20 years old, just about a year ago now, 8 months ago. Very suddenly in a very tragic car accident. Young kid, 20 years old. I coached him in football, American football over here. Great kid. And that was so sudden and shocking. You know, he had his whole life ahead of him. He was into race cars, and he was really up and coming talent. Fantastic kid. Suddenly just snatched away. Like, and now we've got to deal with all the shock and the grief and the loss. you know, and his parents are obviously just devastated. And so how do you work through all that stuff? And they're obviously still working through. I see posts on Facebook all the time from his mom, and she, you know, she misses him desperately. But this is one thing I was going to ask you. They believe that, you know, he's still communicating with them. What about that aspect of it? Because I know that's obviously controversial. Do you do anything around that piece of when the person's departed? Do you believe they can still communicate with the living?
I do. I do believe that. And because I've seen evidence of it, you know, I've seen the research on near-death experience. And I, you know, I personally feel pretty certain that we are consciousness stuck into this physical form. And when the physical form is no more, the consciousness still lives. It's there's a physics law, the law of, what's it called? I don't know, continuing energy or something. There's a wonderful book called The Atheist Afterlife by a guy named David Staume, S-T-A-U-M-E. And he talks about how energy, if a car is careening off a cliff and it blows up and you're in it and your body dies, the energy just of that speed just keeps going. I mean, Einstein said everything just keeps going until it bumps into something that stops it, which only really just redirects it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I think we are. And I don't think that can go away. I think it can maybe disperse in some way, but I think that it can also be contained. And I've seen so much evidence of this, you know, in this conference I produce every year, the Afterlife Conference. This is what we talk about. We have researchers who talk about amazing near-death experiences that people have had, messages that they've received. So I totally believe it because I've seen it, you know, seen it in action.
Yeah, it's very controversial. Obviously, coming from that Christian point of view, that's what they wouldn't think that that's true. These people are either in heaven or hell, and that's just the end of it. They can't communicate with the living. But something my wife has really explored ever since her dad's passed away is sort of getting in touch with that psychic energy like you described. And she's gone to see a couple of psychics here in this country, and she really feels like it's helped her communicate with her dad, that he had some things he wanted to say to her from beyond. And she came back, and I listened to the recording. Actually, the guy recorded the session. It was about 40 minutes long. And there was some stuff he said. There's no way he could have known that. And I know that there are charlatans out there. I'm sure people are saying, oh, they're all fakers and phonies and they're taking advantage of people. And I know there are people out there who do. So that's the downside to this whole thing, isn't it? You could end up being scammed by someone.
Well, you know, we have mediums at the Afterlife Conference, and I've seen some of the best, and we're very picky about them. And we look for something called evidential mediumship. And so evidential is if your wife got a message from her father and he just said, I love you so much. You were such a good daughter.
Yeah, it's a general message. Yeah.
But if he said, remember that time when you went skating and you broke your leg and I carried you all the way to the hospital?
There's no way he could have known that.
No way he could know. And it's even more, I mean, I've seen more evidential than that. Look up a guy named Thomas John. He's an astonishing medium. So yes, that's true. And the interesting thing about, you know, Christians is I always say millions and millions and millions of people believe in an afterlife, but they draw the line at communication being able to go across dimensions. And it really is just a different dimension. And if you think this is the only dimension that exists, that's pretty limited, because we know that it's not. And if you understand that it's a multidimensional universe, then all kinds of surprising things can happen. And, you know, there are studies on deathbed visions that people have and visitations that they get and the dreams that they have. It's absolutely amazing, beautiful stuff. And to me, it doesn't contradict my position against religion, because I am just dead set against religion, but I still believe in this.
Right. Strange irony.
I'm going to have to defend that at the conference in Vancouver, I'm sure.
Someone will ask you that question. Well, it sounds like in your book, do you go more in depth in this toxic theology piece? Because were you reading that from your book? Because I'm fascinated by that element of it. Coming out of evangelicalism myself, I've seen the results of toxic theology as I described in my own life and that of other people. So it sounds like a fantastic resource as far as this whole piece of grief and dying and how that toxic theology and religious element can play into it.
Yeah, well, I don't talk about after-death communication in this new book, but I talk about it in my previous books a lot.
Yeah, you've got other stuff out there. I saw that on Amazon. You've got a few books listed.
Yeah, and those books are very, very much about that stuff because, you know, I was around it and it was happening to me with my son and it was happening to people that I knew. So, of course, I wrote about it. This doesn't even address that, except for the doctrine about it. So, as you know, in the Bible, people are talking to spirits all the time. People are talking.
Exactly.
The donkey is talking, right? You know?
Yeah. Talking donkeys.
Yep. But in Deuteronomy, communing with seers, worshiping the sun and the moon and the stars was punishable by death. Then go forward now into the Christian Bible, and Paul is talking about the gifts of spirit. And we all have the gifts of spirit, including the gift of prophecy and whatever the other gifts are. So, you know, the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible contradicts itself in that. And most Christians who are against talking to spirits are referencing that from the Hebrew Bible, from Deuteronomy.
It's funny, isn't it? Because as you say, it's only legitimate in Christianity if you're prophesying, quote unquote, from God. That's the only thing that works, you know. Paul talks about apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, teachers. So that's okay if it comes true, or if you speak in tongues and somebody interprets it, then you can go, okay, yeah, this is probably from God because we verified it by someone else independently interpreting this tongue. But you know, if it's a medium, nope, that doesn't work. A psychic doesn't work.
This would be my argument with someone who said that to me. Like, well, you know, and I've been in rooms with evangelicals who've said this. Well, I receive messages from God, you know, guidance from spirit all the time. Jesus is always talking to me, you know, and that's different than what a medium or channeler does, because when I do it, it's through the Holy Spirit and it's from God.
Yeah,
and
safe,
so my answer to them is, isn't everything from God? Are there some things in this universe that are from God and some things that are not? And they can't answer that question because, of course, everything is from God. But that's when the concept of Satan got created.
I was going to say, yeah.
How do we explain that? So their answer is, well, good things are from God and bad things are from Satan. And my answer to that is like, what are you, 2 years old?
Yeah. Believe that. But that's the answer, because they'll say, well, good things come from God, but Satan masquerades as an angel of light. And so he could appear to be great and wonderful. And so you could be receiving messages from a psychic, but it's actually opening yourself up to demonic possession or oppression. So you got to be careful because they don't believe in the same things we do. So yeah, you've got to be on your guard all the time, you know, so that's that binary sort of thinking, isn't it? Black and white, good and bad. Satan versus God. We got to be super careful all the time.
So if the medium says, your father is reminding me of the time when you broke your arm, that's from Satan. Why would Satan say something like that? Just to trick you?
Yeah, that's it. He's just that tricky. You know, he'll throw you a bone and then that's when the demons get you. You know, so.
And so, and you know, I would sit there because I wasn't raised in this stuff. So I can kind of ask people these questions from real innocence, you know, because like no one ever taught me this. And I would say like, so, okay, let's play. All right. So Satan's tricking me and he's sending me this evidential message from a medium and it's making me feel so much better because I know my dad is still alive somewhere. Well, okay, I'll call it heaven. How is this bad for me, Christian person? Play this out. Tell me what's going to happen to me in the next few months or years or whatever, because I received this tricky information. What does that look like when it unpacks in my life? I mean, that's what kind of question I would ask them.
What sort of responses would you get? Because I can imagine going down that road and looking at it now out from the outside, I think, my God, what a way to live. How can you tell? You know, the Bible says you got to be discerning. You got to discern all the time, discern between spirits and test the spirits to make sure they're from God and all the rest of it. How do you know? At the end of the day, it's so hard. You've got to be overthinking everything.
Right. And I think the way they would say that you know is back to the two-year-old idea, good things are from God and bad things are from Satan. So if you have ALS when you're 40 years old, it's got to be from Satan because God only does good stuff. So that would mean that all illness, everything we don't like, paying taxes, you know, just stubbing your toe, it's all from Satan. Because in this world, then, if we were right with God, as they say, then we'd live in a day-to-day life where nothing bad ever happened. We'd never stub our toe. We'd never lose our job. Our dog would never die, according to that, if we lived totally in line with that. So then my next question to them would be, so is it possible for a human being to do that? Job tried it. It didn't work for him. So here's you, Mr. Christian, you know, living your life. How come bad things happen to you? How come your kid's a drug addict? Well, Satan got hold of him.
Yeah, everything becomes about Satan. Yeah, exactly. When you start taking it to its logical conclusion, as you say, start pushing them down the road of their actual beliefs when they have to defend it, it's indefensible, really, in a lot of ways. I've been listening to this podcast called The Dogma Debate, and it's a guy, David Smalley, and he interviews evangelical Christians, and he gets into these discussions about he's an atheist, former evangelical. And what strikes me about when he starts pushing them down these roads and they have to really defend their beliefs, how monstrous some of it really actually is when you get into the hell piece and the heaven piece and, you know, why you? Why of all people did God appear to you when there's millions of people suffering and starving and being raped and tortured all over the world? And they're crying out to God and they're not being helped, you know? So it's a monstrous system, actually. So I talk about toxic theology. I don't want to live in that system anymore. It's so damaging.
It's so damaging. And in the end, you end up, as it said in Gone on Trial, you end up powerless. So you go through your whole life giving away your power. And that's what that guy, I told you about, Jeremiah Kamara, who made that movie called Contradiction, you know, says about African-American culture in America and how powerless they have become over time because of the theology that they were given as slaves, which just encouraged them to be submissive, to just relinquish.
Yeah, give up everything. And that's the system. And the toxicity of it all is just amazing. Well, it sounds like you've got a lot of resources. What's your website? Do you have some stuff on your website that people can look at? I know you've listed your books there. What's your web address and how can people get a hold of you?
DanielDirect.net is my primary website. That's my last name, Daniel, DanielDirect.net. The other website for my workshops and teaching is spiritualityandgrief.com. And you know, I have nothing against spirituality. And again, I'm going to have to defend this at a conference, and I'm prepared to do that.
You've got a lot of defending to do.
but, you know, I believe in that there are other dimensions besides just this physical one. And the problem is same with the afterlife. The problem about afterlife discussions is everybody puts afterlife in a religious context. If you could take that context out, you could, you know, be open to the possibility of a multidimensional consciousness that we have. There's a very famous woman named Caitlin Dougherty. She's a mortician. She's young. She's probably about 30. She's written books. She gets tons of press coverage because she's young and pretty and she's a mortician. And she says, I don't believe in an afterlife because I'm not religious. I'm a very secular person. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in an afterlife. And to hear her say that just drives me crazy because it locks those things together. I suppose, technically an atheist or a non-theist too, but I definitely believe in other dimensions of consciousness. You don't have to have the religious piece in order to have that. And that's how I think we can go forward with more enlightenment about.
It sounds like too that you can become locked off to those other possibilities. Yeah, okay, I don't believe in God or whatever your position is, but are you open to spirituality? Are you open to, like you say, the potential of maybe speaking with people from beyond? And that if you walled yourself off to that, maybe you might be missing out on something. I know, like I said, this is something my wife has really explored in the last couple of years. She made the comment the other month that said, you know, when I was a Christian, I don't tell anybody that I'm going to a psychic, even though I don't believe any of it anymore. As far as Christianity, because I'd be so condemned, you know, what are you doing? That's evil. That's wicked. And it's, you know, opening yourself up to all sorts of demonic activity, and, you know, but it's helped her tremendously. she believes in coping with the grief and the loss around her parents.
Well, if you Google Christian mediums, you will find mediums and psychics that call themselves Christian psychics. And you know why? Because it comes from Jesus. They're doing exactly the same thing every other psychic is doing, but they're saying, Jesus is telling me that your father is remembers when you broke your arm.
Well, and the thing is, they can't have it both ways, because there's this ministry in Australia. I don't know if you've heard of them. It's called Christ Alignment. Have you heard of these guys?
No.
This is something to look up. This is part of the Bethel Redding Church out of Redding, California. They're affiliated with some of the leadership of Bethel. But what they do is they go to these New Age and psychic fairs, and they do readings with cards. Now, they're not tarot cards. They're what they call them, destiny cards. And they've got Bible verses on them, and they have beautiful paintings on the cards, just sort of like the tarot cards. But they're like, they call themselves an undercover evangelistic mission, where people think they're getting a psychic reading, and they kind of are. But what these Christ alignment people are doing is they're saying, what we're really aligning people with God through this reading. And so they're doing it with destiny cards. And of course, the Christians are just up in arms about this, because how can you do this? It's none of the pieces fit. You can just hear their heads exploding, because this shouldn't be allowed. But yet, according to what you're saying, they are tapping in potentially to something. Maybe it's not the Christ alignment, but man, evangelicals are just freaking out about this kind of stuff.
Well, but as long as you preface it with Jesus says,
yeah,
right?
Well, that's the thing, is I read a letter from the woman who founded this ministry, and she wrote to one of the leaders at Bethel Redding, because there was this huge controversy around it, and she lays it all out. She says basically what you just said. We are a Christian organization. We are an evangelistic organization. We're just going undercover to these New Age fairs. So it's okay. If people just knew that, they'd get off our backs. You know, so you know, it's just amazing.
New Age people like Jesus too. They have nothing against Jesus. New Age people, the whole idea is to be open to everything. So if you were at a New Age psychic fair and somebody read you or did a reading with Jesus cards, New Age people would be like, yeah, I like Christ consciousness. Sure.
Well, and that's what they find.
Yeah,
The tricky part about it, I think, is the word, the undercover. Yeah. They're not necessarily telling people, you know, they're kind of fooling people. They think they're just getting another sort of psychic reading. And then they find out, wait a minute, these cards have Bible verses on them. What the hell is going on here? You know, but they're very open to it, as you say. So that's her argument. It should be on a pragmatic level. It's working. So what's the problem? We've got Jesus on the cards. We've got Bible verses, man. Come on, you know. And we're seeing thousands of people get saved at these New Age fairs, you know. So,
well, you think that those people are actually saved by having these readings?
It's so bizarre. I'm doing more and more research on it as we speak, on Dominion theology and the many weird sort of spinoffs that it's sort of birthed. You know, there's some strange stuff. But anyway, that's off the subject.
Check out something called Christian yoga. This is just, and I actually wrote about it in my book. There's a woman who, and you know, Christians say, you know what Pat Robertson says about yoga?
Yeah.
It forces you to speak Hindu.
Of course it is.
That's
the worst thing you could possibly do, obviously.
Worst thing. And makes you worship Hindu gods. So this woman comes along and she says, you know, yoga is so terrible for Christians. So she creates something called Christian yoga. And what she did is, it's exactly the same yoga. It's all the same postures, but instead of calling them, for example, you know, tree pose, she calls it, you know, Christ on the cross.
Put a Christian label on it.
Yeah, and she takes all the positions like downward dog and plank and all the yoga positions, and she names them after scripture verses. And it's hysterical to look at her website. I can email you the link. I mean, there's probably a lot.
I would love to see it. But they sanctify these practices, though. I mean, it's no different than Martin Luther making Christian hymns out of drinking songs that they used to sing in pubs in Germany.
Oh, right.
You know, or what we used to do. I used to play in Christian metal bands, and we used to take secular songs, play the same riffs and everything. You'd recognize it as an AC/DC song or whatever, but you put Christian lyrics to it. So everyone knows the tune, everyone knows the song, but if you can Christianize it, now it's okay. You know,
and that's completely illegal.
That's well, we didn't care, man. We were rocking for Jesus, man. You know, that's what we were doing.
So this Christian yoga thing, her name is Laurette Willis. So if you Google her, Laurette, L-A-U.
I have to look that up.
Yeah, it's called Praise Moves. Praise Moves.
Ooh, very clever title.
Yeah, the Christian rock band thing. And that's, you know, the beautiful Leonard Cohen song, Hallelujah, that lots of artists have recorded.
Yeah, ripped off.
I saw some little Christian boys singing that song completely with their own lyrics, making it about Jesus.
Make it about Jesus. Well, it sounds like you've got some work to do at the Court 2020. You're going to have a lot of defending to do at your at this conference. But I hope people reach out to you. It sounds like I'm going to have to look at your book now. I think this is something actually that my wife would be very interested in, because as I've been saying, this is something she's exploring, and it's really piqued my interest in that whole sort of spiritual realm as well. So I'm really glad that you're doing the work that you're doing. So thanks, Terry, for hanging out with me and talking about grief, toxic theology, death, loss, Christian yoga, Christian tarot cards.
You can find it on Amazon, Grief and God by Terry Daniel.
Yeah, I'll put a link to it in the show notes as well as to your website. Do you have also, are you on Twitter, Facebook? What's another way to get a hold of you?
God, I never use Twitter.
Let's say you must not be very active if you don't have your Twitter handle.
I think it's at... Gosh, I don't know. Wait, hold on. I can find out really quick.
You can find it. You could look it up.
I can go right now.
Well, I'll put your Twitter handle in the show notes as well. And maybe then that'll be Tim.
Okay, I found it.
You found it.
At Dr. Terry Daniel 1. Dr. D.R. Terry.
Right,
Terry.
Okay. So I'll put your Twitter, even though you never use it, I'll put it in there anyway.
I think I have 100 followers.
Hey, that's 100 more than most people do, if they're never on it. So. Happy days. All right. So listen, Terry, thank you so much for chatting with me. Be interested to hear what happens at your conference in 2020. See if you get, some good response to what you're going to be presenting.
Well, let's definitely stay in touch. And I just absolutely love talking to you. And I hope we can do this again sometime soon.
We'll definitely touch base again. So thank you so much, Terry. I will speak to you again.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.